It's Central Time. I'm Jay Carlisle Larson.
And I'm Judith Sears Poisson. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, the number of startup companies choosing to go public has seen a sharp drop in the last 20 years. We'll look at the reasons why and how it could affect America's wealth gap.
First, three former Milwaukee County Jail employees face felony charges in the dehydration death of Milwaukee inmate Terrell Thomas.
Thomas, who had been in isolation, died in April 2016 when the water in his cell was turned off for 7 days.
Chuck Quernbach is a reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio News based in Milwaukee. Chuck, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
So remind us, what were the circumstances that led to the water being turned off in Thomas's cell?
Well, Mr. Thomas had been arrested in April of 2016, accused of shooting a man and also firing shots at the Pottawatomie Casino in Milwaukee. He was taken eventually to the Milwaukee County Jail in the downtown area. He was accused then of tearing up or disturbing the cell he was in and flooding the cell, and he was taken to a different cell, and where eventually the water was turned off in the cell, and it was not turned back on. 7 days, 34 pounds that he lost later, he passed away.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong here, but it was determined that Terrell Thomas had bipolar disorder, correct?
That's correct. So the criticism of this case has partly been, how could you turn anyone's water off? And then it's augmented by, how can you turn off the water of someone with bipolar disorder whose family says his gun use was a part of a psychotic episode?
Now, getting us to today, who was charged?
Okay, three people that were charged were Major Nancy Evans, who was basically day-to-day commander of the jail, also Lieutenant Koshka Metters, who ordered the water be turned off, and James Ramsey Guy, a correctional officer, who did turn the water off. The problems for the superiors, and especially Major Evans, was there was apparently video of the water being turned off. She asked a subordinate to review it, but took no steps to preserve the video surveillance. And she's charged with misconduct in office for that type of thing, and also obstructing an officer, or really an investigator, who looked into the video issue later. Ramsey Guy and Metters are charged with felony charges of neglecting an inmate.
Now, what is the current status of these three employees?
Well, acting Milwaukee County Sheriff Richard Schmidt, who has experience working in the jail but was not did not have direct oversight over the jail when this all happened in April of 2016, he announced yesterday at the news conference that Evans, Metters, and Ramsey Guy have been suspended with pay per county rules. He will announce on Friday if there's going to be additional penalties, such as firing and so on. Of course, the three are accused of misconduct, accused of felonies, and will have their time in court. And at least one of their attorneys is suggesting don't rush to judgment here. There's more to it.
We are talking to Chuck Quernbach right now. He is a reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio News based in Milwaukee, and he's updating us on the Terrell Thomas case. Terrell Thomas died of dehydration in the Milwaukee County Jail. Felony charges have been filed in connection to those officers who cut off his water. Now, Chuck, at a press conference this week, Milwaukee County District Attorney John Chisholm spoke about these charges. Here he is speaking about Milwaukee County Sheriff's Major Nancy Evans, who did have command responsibility in the jail, as you previously just said.
And if they are not, there's also an obligation to assist in the investigation in a timely and complete manner. And if that doesn't happen, the risk is, of course, that you lose evidence.
Now, what did we learn about the state of this investigation?
Well, he's talking about there whether proper procedures were followed, and that Evans allegedly did not follow them. As I say, there was this video that Evans ordered an aide to look at, and then that apparently showed the water was never turned back on. Evans took no steps to preserve the video surveillance. So it showed, all this went, as far as the whole investigation, all of this A lot of it went to an inquest jury last year that District Attorney Chisholm convened. He recommended the inquest jury suggested, advised charges against seven people. Chisholm chose three that he said yesterday we think are the most responsible.
So what could be the status of those other four people who were pointed to by the inquest jury?
Well, the impression Mr. Chisholm gave yesterday that the other four will not be charged. It's possible that there could be charges, I suppose, but this has gone on for a long time. He's named the three that he thinks he has the strongest case against. And he is still investigating the role of the medical provider, the private contractor that provides medical services in the jail, Armor Correctional Health Services, as far as the dehydration, whether Mr. Thomas, as he was literally dying in the cell, should have received more medical care, more helpful medical care.
Now, yesterday, we also heard from Milwaukee County Sheriff Richard Schmidt. This is what he had to say during that press conference.
My heart bleeds for these people. I'm a human being. I have family members. If this turns out to be exactly the way things have been written, it's horrific. So my heart goes out to the family.
He's saying that the manner with which Terrell Thomas is alleged to have died is horrific. Has his death spurred any changes at the jail to prevent future issues like this?
Well, supposedly, yes. As he said at the news conference yesterday, and as our colleague Jimena Conde reported in our web story on this, Schmidt said that wellness officers have been brought on staff to check on the inmates, that the National Institute of Corrections are coming in to investigate or sort of check on the jail in a few weeks, and that Schmidt has said as he said in that soundbite, is quite troubled by all this. He is promising that it's a very important issue to him. District Attorney Chisholm said that the jail folks have a fundamental obligation to make sure the inmates are safe. So there seems to be plenty of attention by the people in charge, Richard Schmidt, also John Chisholm, that this is a serious issue. But at the same time, since Thomas's death, seven people have died in the jail, and I think there were some just before Thomas as well. Three have died since Schmidt took office after David Clark left. So Schmidt was saying yesterday that he gets thousands of people through the jail. Many have mental health or drug-related issues. Not everything is going to rise to a crime in these deaths, but Thomas's certainly did because of this water issue.
You were just saying that, seven people so far have died since Thomas's death was originally reported. Schmidt is saying we're going to be working on this, making sure that this stuff doesn't happen. I mean, you said that it's also not always going to rise to the level of a crime. Has there been any indication that they're going to try to bring those numbers down, even though they might seem not as high?
Well, another factor here, of course, is that Schmidt is the acting sheriff after David Clark left. Mr. Schmidt has applied for a permanent job, the job permanently. Governor Scott Walker has been holding on to the applications for Milwaukee County Sheriff. Walker recently said that he was sort of waiting to see what would come out of the investigation into Thomas's death. So Governor Walker may play a role in what happens at the jail if he decides to keep Schmidt or if he decides to appoint another sheriff who would have to stand for election in the next year or two. So a little bit in Scott Walker's ballpark, I would say, on this.
You just mentioned David Clark. He was the former Milwaukee County Sheriff. Has he said anything about this case? He's obviously not in office anymore, but has he commented?
I haven't seen anything since the charges were announced yesterday. He did suggest earlier in the investigation that the media were focusing on what happened in jail and not as much on what Mr. Thomas is alleged to have done, firing guns and so on, and that Clark has also suggested it's very difficult work in the jail, and I think everyone acknowledges that, that you're dealing with folks who don't want to be there by and large and are often having their own problems inside the jail. But Clark is, you know, hasn't said much since then, but certainly because he was involved and was a prominent supporter of Donald Trump throughout 2016 and into 2017. This case also got a lot of national attention because of Clark's being in charge of, ultimately in charge of the jail while when Mr. Thomas died.
Well, Chuck, thank you so much for that update today.
Thank you.
Chuck Quernbach is the reporter based in Milwaukee for Wisconsin Public Radio News. He joined us today to talk about felony charges filed in the death of Milwaukee County Jail inmate Terrell Thomas.
Right now, for startup companies that are looking to grow, becoming publicly traded has traditionally been a smart move. But fewer and fewer startups are choosing to join the stock market. In 1997, for example, more than 7,500 firms were publicly listed in the U.S. Today, the number is less than half that.
Our next guest thinks that could be bad news for the economy. She says the trend is preventing smaller investors and everyday people from sharing in the benefits of growing companies, and it could potentially widen America's wealth gap.
Gwynne Guilford is a reporter covering the global economy for Quartz. Gwynne, welcome to Central Time.
It's great to be here.
Before we get into some of the reasons why, can you first talk about the shift we've seen over the years in the number of startups that are going public?
So that the number of startups going public has declined sharply since the late 90s. So the companies that are listed have gotten bigger and they're older, and increasingly young companies are just avoiding IPOs altogether.
And why do we think that is?
So one of the reasons is that it reflects changes in the structure of the American economy. So, you know, 40, 30 years ago, we used to be our big companies were industrial companies, and when they needed to grow, they needed to invest in building really expensive factories and upgrading their machinery. And now we've transitioned more to what's sometimes called a knowledge economy. And, you know, it's more focused on services, digital technology, information, and those assets are increasingly, you know, focused on knowledge and intellectual capital that that's measured in a totally different way from how industrial companies are measured.
Gwynne, you found that as more startups are functioning in the digital realm, you know, that incentive to get infusion of capital to, say, buy a factory or, you know, buy other kind of capital investments has diminished with those public offerings. So how are those new style startups getting funding? Because clearly they still need money. It's just that they're maybe not buying stuff the way that more traditional enterprises did.
That's right. So the startups in general are invested in by private equity and venture capital funds. And one thing that happened that allowed the shift to happen was that in the mid-1990s, there was deregulation of that industry that made it easier for private equity funds to, which are basically they pool investments from a bunch of very rich people and also pension funds, and invest those in companies, and venture capital tends to invest more in startups, but that difference isn't that important. Basically, these companies are able to, like a startup company is able to attract the investment it needs to grow from that pool of funds from really rich people. And so they don't need to go public the way companies used to do in order to raise the capital they need to grow.
And those companies, those new startups that are relying, as you said, more on knowledge, perhaps, or things like software development, digital developments, they are wanting to protect the advances that they're making in a way that it seems like maybe a more traditional style manufacturing enterprise might not need to in the same way.
Right. So one of the things that happens when you go public is, of course, you publicize your financial operations. So you have to disclose to investors, and there are very strict guidelines about that, what you're spending on and, you know, your investments and your assets. And, you know, no one's going to steal a car plant. You know, you can tell your investors about that, and your competitors aren't going to – there's nothing to steal there. But in the fast-moving world of, you know, people inventing algorithms and, you know, new drugs for pharmaceuticals and things like that, the edge comes from this, you know, this specialized knowledge, and competitors can very easily steal that. So you don't want to be forced to publicize what you're investing in, what you're developing, lest your competitors steal it and you lose the value of your company.
So basically you could do a lot of the legwork, make it public, and somebody else could kind of swoop in and take advantage of that.
Exactly.
We're talking with Gwynne Guilford right now. She's a reporter covering the global economy for Quartz, and we're talking about a trend that fewer and fewer startups are offering their stocks publicly. And Gwynne, I'm guessing that there are some people who are listening and thinking, well, this is all interesting, but what does it have to do with me? So what does this trend have to do with, as you said, for instance, people who might have money in the stock market through a retirement fund or a 401k?
Sure. Well, so the one thing that's happening as a result of this trend is that it makes it harder for retail investors to diversify. So fewer public companies means, and, you know, the main way we're able to invest is through, you know, the stock market, through our E-Trade accounts or through our 401ks. Fewer public companies means fewer things to invest in, fewer choices, right? And that leaves people more exposed to risk and makes it easier for them to lose a lot of money if something, you know, hits a particular sector and they're, you know, more exposed than they would have been if there had been more companies to invest in. So that's one thing. The other thing is that it, when startups are not, you know, listing and giving retail investors an opportunity to get a part of, you know, of their future growth, and they tend to grow much faster than established companies. And it's only the private equity funds that are able to, you know, profit from that explosive growth of new startups with new ideas and stuff like that. And so, you know, that sort of exacerbates the major problem in our economy right now, which is, you know, inequality of wealth.
And you also wrote that there is the issue that there are fewer of these companies that are available, like you said, for, you know, retirement funds or pension funds to invest in. You also said that a lot of these startups are growing kind of off the grid in that way, with the hope of being absorbed by a much larger company. So it seems like there are two different ways that the number of companies are shrinking. There's the decrease in the number of companies, startups that are being offered for IPOs, but then also there are more and more mergers, which has been a trend for quite a while now already.
Right, that's exactly right. And that brings us to another issue, which is intensifying industry concentration. So, you know, as there's the shift away from IPOs and then the increase in acquisitions and heavy overlap between those two phenomena, that creates these, like, mega-huge companies with huge amounts of market power and less competition, and that's bad for consumers ultimately.
Publicly traded companies also have to maintain at least some level of transparency for their investors, and as a result, there are also reports that have to be filed with the government, et cetera. But that's not the case with these startups that are staying private. Are we at risk of losing transparency and all that can come with that, that we've seen in, you know, all kinds of financial institutions and other problems in the economy?
Yeah, we certainly are. One of the knock-on benefits of the disclosure rules required of public companies is that, you know, there's a societal good, and that's transparency. Basically, in order to be public, you have to say what you're doing and say what you're spending your money on, and that makes it easy for reporters to you know, figure out if you're doing something that's bad for the general public, right? And so that could be, you know, for instance, like in spending on things that are polluting or are, you know, privacy issues or financially risky activity. So the shift away from public listings means that, you know, fewer of our companies are subject to these disclosure rules, and so that sort of that forced oversight is diminished, and that could, you know, ultimately makes the corporate sector more opaque.
So if I'm understanding this correctly, whether or not any one individual is invested in the stock market, these developments and these trends could impact all of us because it could have a huge impact on the economy as a whole.
Yeah, that's exactly right. This change is reflecting, but it's also creating, you know, major shifts in how our economy works and, you know, to whom the companies that are the engines of our growth are, you know, accountable to. And so that definitely has implications for the public good.
And briefly, as we wrap up, Gwen, is there anything that you see that might reverse this trend?
Unless we have a major change in the way accounting is done, although that's not, you know, under discussion, or the structure of the economy, you know, we start, you know, have an industrial revival, probably not. No, these trends seem to be here for a while and probably intensifying.
Well, Gwen, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Gwen Guilford is a reporter covering the global economy for Quartz. She shared what's behind a decrease in startup companies going public and what it could mean for the economy. First, a new book looks at how we begin making judgments at a very early age. Both praise and blame can have a big impact on us throughout our lives. And our next guest says it can affect our friendships, our marriages, our jobs, and much more.
Joining us now to tell us more about praise and blame is Terry Apter. Terry is an author and psychologist, and she's with us to talk about her latest book, Passing Judgment, Praise and Blame in Everyday Life. Welcome to Central Time, Terry.
Well, I'm delighted to be talking to you.
So, Terry, what brought you to feel that these two concepts, praise and blame, were so key to our lives that you wanted to write a book about it?
Well, I've been working for decades on child development, looking how children develop within the family, family dynamics, and close relationships, you know, with friends, with siblings. And I noticed that one of a very key repeated feature was whether one felt one was praised within the relationship or whether one felt one was blamed. And, you know, in very close, intimate relationships, you often feel that somebody is going to accept you totally, and you talk about unconditional love. And the love itself and the attachment may be unconditional, but you also want to feel approved of. If you know, if a child feels that they're deficient, that they're not pleasing their parents, that their parents aren't finding things in them that are wonderful, they feel very threatened, very down. And so I really wanted to lift this theme of praise and blame and also put it in the context of how judgmental we are. We're constantly making judgments. And by judgments, I mean both positive and negative ones. So, you know, praise, you're making a judgment as well as blame. You know, this is your fault or you're somehow deficient. And once I started looking through that lens, I felt it was very helpful to pick that out and look at it in a, you know, a range of phases in our lives, because our concern about how we're praised and whether we're praised and by whom, that changes according to how old we are and our context. I felt this was a very good way of picking out some of the dynamics that have often been missed in these important relationships.
So let's start, I guess, at the beginning, if it's something that it's kind of interwoven into our lives. Infants as young as 1 year old are already making judgments. I guess a two-parter. One, is that a surprise? And how do we know that?
Well, I think their early judgments are two-pronged. I mean, at first, the newborn baby is responsive to that loving, admiring curiosity of parents, and that's felt as praise. And we know that praise relaxes us. It opens us up to new things. It actually has a chemical impact on the brain. There are more of those endorphin compounds that make us feel good. And in that context, for a brand new baby, that actually helps the brain grow. It helps make new neuron connections. Now, what is indeed surprising is how, at what an early stage, children, babies, make judgments of others. So you've asked, how do we know this? Well, one of several ways is you show an 11-month-old some puppets, and one puppet picks up a ball that is dropped and hands it to the person or the puppet who dropped it. Another puppet picks up a dropped ball and runs away with it. So this 11-month-old is looking at a skit or players or puppets where one is cooperative and the other isn't, doing something kind of antisocial. And that 11-month-old, by 11 to 12-month-old, a child will not want to play with a puppet who is uncooperative, will not want to give that puppet treats, and will take treats away from the uncooperative puppet and give it to the cooperative ones. So there's a strong sense that even though that child, him or herself, isn't directly impacted by this cooperative versus antisocial behavior, they're making a judgment, they're having a view. And this is what we do all the time, every day. We're always making judgments about other people and our interactions with them. Are they safe? Are they trustworthy? Are they cooperative? Do they get me? Are they fun to be with? Do they understand me? Are they curious about me? Are they warm? All of these things are with us every day.
Well, it's really fascinating to hear you talk about sort of early judgment in children. I think we're frequently told, don't be so judgmental, but it sounds as though we can actually benefit a fair amount by even these early stages of learning about the world around us and helps us navigate it a little more. So moving from infants to children, as children get older, we will frequently use praise or potentially blame to teach lessons to children to help them move along. How have our ideas changed about praising children over the years?
Well, at one time, if you're looking quite a way back, say at the beginning of the last century, it was often thought that you shouldn't praise children because it would go to their head. They shouldn't think too much of themselves. They shouldn't expect too much. But more recently, it was then thought that you should feed children a steady diet of praise, that their environment should contain almost nothing but praise. You should praise them for turning up. You should tell them to praise themselves every day. You're wonderful. You're terrific. And it was thought that this was a way of protecting their self, of boosting their self-esteem. But more recently, and surprisingly, it was found that if you offer nothing but praise. And if that praise is diffuse, if it's unfocused, if it's for just about anything, that can be very confusing and even demotivating, because a child doesn't, you know, children themselves tend to have very high standards for praise. If a child does just a scribble, you say, oh my goodness, that's genius, wonderful, it will be confusing, it will may be frustrating, because a child may be trying to do something very specific and sees that he or she is not, and I've seen children get very cross if they're praised for something that is, you know, that isn't in sync with their aims. And this is an element of praise that I think stays with us. I mean, when I went into the workplace, women in particular were very sensitive to praise that might seem patronizing. It might indicate surprise that they could do something. It could also be very distracting. So if they went in to give a presentation and somebody said, oh, you know, nice shoes you're wearing, that could be unsettling, because it would change the focus from what they were trying to do and how they were trying to engage other people to something that was off message and possibly demeaning. So, you know, praise is thought to be always good, but we can be very fussy about it, and it can make us very cross and very irritated.
We are talking to Terry Apter right now. She's a psychologist and author. Her latest book is Passing Judgment, Praise and Blame in Everyday Life.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. What kind of things do you praise others for? How does judging yourself and others affect your relationships? And how do you react to praise or blame? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email us at ideas@wpr.org.
We'll pick up that conversation after this short break. Stay with us here on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson.
And I'm Jay Carlisle-Larson. Right now, we continue our conversation with Terry Apter about her new book, Passing Judgment, Praise and Blame in Everyday Life. We're talking about balancing praise and blame in your life and answering your questions at 800-642-1234.
Do you have questions about the best way to give praise as a parent? How judgmental are you, and how does that affect your relationships? And was there a significant moment in your life that you were given praise or blame for something, and how did that affect you? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or you can tweet us at CentralTimeWPR.
Now, Terry, before we went to the break, we were talking about how sometimes praise, especially if it's diffuse, can maybe throw people off of their game a little bit. You were specifically talking about women. So my question now is, how do men and women accept praise?
Well, there are a lot of myths about the way women versus men respond to praise. And it's often said that women are much more keen to please other people. In fact, what I found was that women were often, if they were being assessed formally, let's say in the workplace, they were very used to neutral or even negative comments. And they really liked praise if it was for something that had challenged them and something that they felt they'd done well on. But if it was for something that was sort of absolutely routine, then they would get pretty upset about it. Men loved praise, and they believed it fairly easily, but they would get very defensive if there was any little bit of blame. And in marriage, this is another thing where men and women's responses are different. women are better and more adept at offering those little bits of praise and appreciation that can keep the relationship running smoothly. But if there's any sign of conflict and any implication of blame, men get stressed much more quickly, and this stress can be seen, you know, in their physiological response, heart rate, blood pressure, perspiration, all of that can really go very high much more quickly than women. Women would be happier to talk about why are you blaming me, why is it this, why do you think this is my fault. Men get upset very, very quickly, and for that reason they often shut down, or what's often called stonewalling. They, you know, they'll turn into a stone wall. They won't respond, they'll leave the room. And this different physiological response to conflict, particularly blame and interpersonal relationships, underlies that very different response.
Now, Terry, I want to take a call really quickly. We have Mark in Wauwatosa who wants to chime in. Mark, what do you want to say?
Hi, thanks for taking my call. So I believe it was a study that was just recently released from the University of California, Berkeley, where they found that children that receive too much praise or unwarranted praise, it has a negative effect not only in childhood but also into their adult life, in that it has the same type of effect as like participation ribbons, where if everybody's receiving something, nobody really strives to do better. And it also then, when those children grow up, they found that, this was like a 20-year study, they found that the adults, where they went from being overly praised as children, don't necessarily like evaluate and accept praise or critique correctly, because their perception of what is praiseworthy is so distorted from their childhood.
Mark, thank you so much for that call. So, Terry, we're hearing a couple of things, that too much praise might completely skew our reactions as adults. Did you find that?
Well, yes. And indeed, those are solid findings in the field, that children who have nothing but praise don't know how to evaluate criticism. If they get criticism, if they get any kind of criticism, they may say, I must be awful at this, I must not put myself again in this situation, I must avoid this at all costs. And it's much better to ensure that a child understands how to respond to what might seem like negative feedback. You know, you're not doing something right doesn't mean, you know, shouldn't be alien to a child. A child, all of us, whenever we're trying something new, we have to accept that sometimes we're not going to do it well, and we may not see this ourselves, and we may need to be told by someone else. It might point it out, you're not doing this as it should be. And if that is alien to us, we won't be able to learn from it and absorb it and go forward. And, you know, if you're terrified of any kind of criticism or any kind of negative response, because that just isn't something you're used to, then you're not going to learn. You're not going to learn that it's safe to apply yourself to try something and then fail, but then learn how to do it better. And those are the lessons that we may be depriving children of if we just feed them a steady diet of praise, if we give them a ribbon, a prize for just turning up.
Now, looking at the way that praise and blame plays out in relationships, I know that this was one of the topics that you covered in your book, particularly marriages, relationships. Is there, I mean, obviously no relationship is going to be without blame or praise, but is there, I guess, a magic number or ratio that can keep those relationships growing and but not too fraught?
Right. Well, especially in marriage, where the assumption is that you're going to be there for one another, you do admire one another, you know, even when there are down times and mess ups, the person is basically good. But there will be criticism and blame. You know, you're not loving me enough, you're not understanding me, you're not giving me what I want, you haven't mended the faucet, you know, whatever. There's lots of that. And having blame doesn't necessarily mean it's a bad marriage, but there has to be more praise than blame. As a matter of fact, blame is so negative, has such a negative impact, that you need at least 5 interchanges that involve praise before you can, in order to repair the damage that blame can do to a relationship. So you're bound to have it. You're bound to have blame and conflict, and the marriage can survive. But you need to have at least 5 times more interchanges that involve some kind of praise.
Now, in the last, say, minute that we have here, Terry, you know, to pay attention to praise and blame throughout our lives and being able to discern the two and maybe not take praise too much or take blame too much. Do you have any tips as to how we can pay better attention to the subtleties between the two and maintain a balance there?
Well, first of all, I think we have to accept that we are judgmental beings. That's what our minds do, and this is how we navigate our interpersonal worlds. I think we have to realize how damaging, how painful blame is, and so we can manage that by focusing on it. I've talked about focus in praise, but we also have to focus on blame. What precisely is it that hasn't worked? Where precisely is the deficiency? Where is the accountability? And when you do that, you can put it in a context of, you can learn from this and you can do better next time. I believe in, in a better future self. And then I think praise has to be in sync with the person's own goals and values. You have to always be curious about what a person is aiming for, what they value, and make sure the praise is not just routine and formulaic, but it actually addresses their values and their efforts and their goals.
Well, Terry, thank you so much for joining us today. This was great.
Well, it's been a pleasure.
That was Terry Apter. She is the author of Passing Judgment, Praise and Blame in Everyday Life. She's also a psychologist, and we've been looking at the way praise and blame as being sort of two sides of the judgment coin is basically with us from, you know, our infancy to our adulthood. You can keep that conversation going at the Ideas Network Facebook page. This is Central Time. So it's February 13th, and everyone knows what that means. It's Galentine's Day. So, okay, maybe most people might not be familiar with Galentine's Day, but we're going to let Leslie Knope explain what it is.
It's only the best day of the year. Every February 13th, my lady friends and I leave our husbands and our boyfriends at home, and we just come and kick it breakfast style. Ladies celebrating ladies. It's like Lilith Fair, minus the angst, plus frittatas.
Leslie Knope is from the NBC show Parks and Rec. And Galentine's Day, I have to admit, JC, this was not something I was familiar with, but I love it.
Yeah, it's a really fun concept. We were talking about it this morning in our meeting with our fellow producer, Brianne Shasso, who's a big fan of Parks and Rec. I know people that have been hosting Galentine's Day since its inception on Parks and Rec. It's, I guess we were reading that it became a new fake holiday, another one that NBC has kicked
NBC
off.
Also gave us Festivus.
You know, two of the great fake holidays in the pantheon.
Right. I love the idea, and I'm going to mark my calendar for next year to do something for Galentine's
Day. I feel
Day.
Like any excuse to hang out with friends and eat frittata is like always good.
Exactly.
And what we missed in the rest of the scene is her giving about a bunch of crazy presents to her friends. So maybe
we'll stick with the frittata, maybe. This is Central Time.